Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
If you think you know about world history of cuisine, forget about it. We're going to change your mind today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, here on heritageradionetwork.org. And today, I didn't mean to completely insult everybody out there, but we do have some challenges to some of your thoughts about the history of cuisine or food history. My guest today is Rachel Loudon, and Rachel is the author of the newly published Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. It's a wonderful new book that covers a lot of information. We'll try to bring you some of it today. She uses her knowledge of farming from her English upbringing and her experience living and cooking and dining on five different continents, her scholarly career as a historian of science and technology with a PhD from the University of London, to challenge the agrarian, romantic, domestic myths of contemporary food movement. Since she left academia to write freelance about food and history and politics, she's also has written the prize-winning Food of Paradise, Exploring Hawaii's Culinary History. It's a beautiful book about Hawaii. And she served as scholar-in-residence for the International Association of Culinary Professionals and has given keynote addresses at numerous academic and culinary conferences. After 15 years of living in Mexico, she now lives in Austin, Texas, where she joins us by phone. Welcome, Rachel.
Welcome, Linda. It's great to be on the show.
Well, I have to tell you, I have not completed the book. It's a book you want to savor, and I didn't want to just breeze through it. So I did skim certain parts of it and taken it upon your advice of where to go to bring our listeners the details of this, but I want to talk about just the broader notion of the history of cuisines. And you say that you challenge the contemporary thought of food history or the food movement, and the movement that you set forth in this book, let's say the culinary family tree. Talks about only a handful of cuisines, perhaps, as being the history. Can you tell us what you mean by this challenge and where you're starting from?
Well, I'm starting when I really wanted to take on food in world history, because we have world histories of disease, of warfare, of religion. And it seemed to me not to have a world history of food was a big gap. But then the trouble was what is food? Because food so often covers everything from farming up to dining in restaurants or the home, and it seemed just impossibly huge. And so the way I tried to define this was to say, look, we've got to take seriously the fact that we are the animal that eats things that have been cooked. It's true, a few of our calories come from raw foods, but by and large, the human race depends on food that has been cooked, which immediately means that you're talking about styles of cooking as they develop. And that's a style of cooking for me is a cuisine. Mm-hmm. By cuisine, I don't mean automatically a high cuisine. I simply mean a style of cooking. And of course, you can subdivide styles of cooking down to the individual household if you want to. But I was trying to get what you might call a flyover roadmap of what was going on. So, yes, I do have rather few cuisines that I trace the history of.
Uh-huh. Now, a lot of people relate one cuisine to one empire. You kind of blew that out of the water as well.
Yes, it's, I think, not just to one empire, but nowadays we really expect one cuisine to every nation. And you only have to go into a cookbook store to see this. You know, you can look at, first of all, techniques, and then you'll go to sort of regional cuisines, and there'll be the Vietnamese cuisines and the Italian cuisine books and the French cuisine books and the Mexican cuisine books. But when you look at world history, you realize that the nation is really a very recent phenomenon. Many nations have only been formed in the last couple of generations following the breakup of the European empires. And even the older nations really only go back about a couple of hundred years. So the question is, what happened before there were nations? Because you can't really have a national cuisine unless you have a political nation. And the big political units before nations, they overlap with nations, are empires. And what you find is that although you might think there would be one cuisine per one empire, it's always been the case that people have looked at successful societies, successful empires, successful political units, and said, well, maybe one reason they're successful is because their people are eating really well. And so there's always been copying of cuisines from one empire or one political unit to another.
And you actually give a very good example of this, and that was in talking about the Islamic influence on Mexican cuisine.
Yes, I mean, that's a fascinating case, because what you have is that the year that Columbus set sail for the Americas is also the year when the Moors, the Islamic influence is finally ended in southern Spain. But southern Spain had been under ruled by Muslim leaders for hundreds of years before that. They had imported the cuisine that they wanted from the Middle East, from Baghdad, which was the kind of cultural capital of the Islamic world in the Middle Ages, and it had become established in a slightly modified form in southern Spain, in Al-Andalus, as it was called. And then, of course, when the Spanish moved to the New World, they took with them the cuisine that they knew, the cuisine they had grown up with, which was a Christianized version of the Islamic cuisine, which had originated hundreds of years beforehand in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say they, when they traveled to this new country, they took the cuisine they knew with them. And that brings me to the cover of the book. You, in another interview that you gave with Alicia Harris, you described the meaning of the cover of the book, and it's a wonderful print. And one has to, you know, you do a double take when you look at it. Could you talk, because that really speaks to bringing a cuisine you know to another country. So talk to me about that.
Yes, it's a Japanese print that was produced in 1862, just after Japan had been, as they say, opened to the West. And it shows two Americans, great big Americans in Western dress, sitting in a kitchen that would have been very foreign to the Japanese, and one of them is baking raised bread in an oven, and the other one is preparing a meal. It looks like some kind of stew or meatballs on an enclosed stove. And clearly the Japanese here are looking at these people who have recently arrived on their shores, and one of the things they're really fascinated by is the way in which they cook, which is very different from the Japanese method.
Right. As I say, it's a book that causes you to do a double take, because when you first glance at it and you see the Japanese characters written on the, you know, on the stove or identifying the print, and you think, oh, I see, it's an old, you know, picture of a Japanese print, and then upon second look, yes, you do recognize the fact that these are different characters. Well, just as you say, you know, travelers, explorers, bringing little bits of food with them, and they're not little bits of food, their style of cooking, their cuisine, in other words, as you say, their style of cooking. And I love the fact that the book is all about cooking, really. It's about cooking and food being and deciding and describing the history. And that, to me, is so important in our studies. And one thing that you put at the center of the book, that you yourself say you put at the center of the book, is culinary philosophy. When you say culinary philosophy, what exactly do you mean, and what is its impact on this history?
It's all the things we think about when we are planning a meal. I have to admit that the idea is taken in part from Kamelia Panjabi, who is a wonderful culinary entrepreneur, economist, cookbook writer, working between India and London. And I heard her once say, well, look, what does a Hindu housewife do when she is planning a meal? And she explains, well, she thinks about the season, the availability of produce. She thinks about the Ayurveda system and whether heating or cooling foods are called for in the sense of humoral properties, not simply hot and cold in temperature terms. She says, you have to consider your family God and whether what day of the week it is, because certain foods are appropriate to the family God on certain days of the week. You have to consider your astrology, and also that goes into it. And then, of course, there are basic things like who's coming to dinner, what their preferences are, are the colors going to make an attractive plate, and so on and so forth. And I listened to this, and I thought, my goodness, I don't, think about my astrologer or my family God, but I go through exactly the same kinds of motions when I'm planning a meal. So that when we're thinking about what we're going to eat, and I think we always think before, thinking comes first, we bring to any food preparation this whole raft of very basic beliefs that I divide up into kind of three sets. One is the social, political, economic beliefs that we have. Do we believe that certain foods are appropriate to certain peoples, to certain ranks of society? Then there are the moral or religious beliefs that we have. What is the right way we should eat? And then there are the beliefs about the natural world. What should we eat that is appropriate to our bodies, appropriate to the farming we have, and so on and so forth. And all these considerations get brought to both planning an individual meal and also more collectively to the way society organizes its food. They become so internalized, of course, that we don't think about them explicitly until we're given a jolt, as I was when I heard this story about the Hindu housewife and her planning, because obviously she was bringing a very different set of beliefs to how she should plan a meal. And so there was this both parallel between thinking about what she was going to do and the difference of coming from a radically different culinary philosophy from mine.
Mm, indeed. Getting back to the families of cuisines, or the culinary family tree, as you so aptly put it, can you tease out for us, like, some of the, you said maybe there's only a half a dozen or so, what some of the, briefly mention the major movements?
Sure. I mean, obviously, all of these can be subdivided, but what you find early on with the first states is that very quickly most cuisines become, most people opt for a cuisine based on grains, I think for the very practical reason that grains are the easiest foodstuffs to provision cities and armies with.
Well, and so anyone, right, and anyone studying food history and culinary history knows that that's where you start. I mean, once we were able to domesticate grains, then the world took off.
Yeah, Exactly. So you quickly, of all the possible foodstuffs in the world, you quickly get cuisines based on grains. And by, say, 1000 BC, that's the way the world is. Mm. And it stays that way with rather more grains than we think about at the moment. The Chinese are still primarily eating millet, for example. Really, until the big world religions come along, and the big world religions reshape these grain cuisines to fit with Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism or Christianity, instead of, as previously, a belief that sacrifice was the basic religious way of mode. So in the early empires, you have grains and the archetypal meal, the meal that joins society and the gods and the individual, had been the sacrificial feast, the feast after offering the gods food in sacrifice. With the big world religions, you get a search for food as a way of personal enlightenment instead of a bargain with the gods. And I think roughly the three most important big world cuisines based on world religions are Buddhist cuisines, which transform the whole of the eastern half of Eurasia, Islamic cuisines, which transform the whole central part of Eurasia, and Christian cuisines, which come, I mean, chronologically, Christianity comes before Islam, but the great expansion of Christian cuisines is with the move to the Americas, with the expansion of the Spanish and Portuguese empires in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. So that's your sort of second big stage, and then sort of quite out of the blue, really, from a really backward part of what had been a sort of backwater of culinary history, northwestern Europe, you get, thanks to the enormous changes that take place in the 17th century in religion with the appearance of Protestantism, in political thought with the Peace of Westphalia and the development of modern Western nations, theories about the natural world with a change from the humoral system to modern nutritional theory, then you get modern Western cuisines, which spread enormously with the European empires and which are picked up in modified form by a lot of other countries around the world, particularly Japan.
Mm. It's interesting because you set it out so concisely that in your premise it's easy to see how all these different cuisines have crossed these boundaries, political boundaries, religious boundaries, and it makes sense. Are you ready? Are you ready for some good scholastic debate? Or
well, obviously, any book that makes such, you know, broad claims is asking for debate, and I really hope I get it because, you know, I come from, as you mentioned, I was a historian of science, and I think one thing that everybody who studies science internalizes is that the way we come to better understanding of the natural world is by, you know, trying out big ideas and then discovering where we're wrong. So, you know, I hope people will come along and say you're wrong here and you're wrong there, but at least, you know, you gave us some interesting ideas to think about.
That's right. That's right. We have to take a very short break. And sure, as soon as we come back, we're going to be talking more about food history.
You are listening to This One by Snowmine on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from A Taste of the Past.
Across the lake, following is an actor reading an actual customer email from Heritage Foods USA.
My family and I enjoyed the Heritage turkey. It was far superior to the regular mass-produced turkeys in terms of flavor and texture. Absolutely delicious and worth the difference in price. We will never go back to the regular turkeys. It made our holidays more enjoyable. Thank you, Heritage Foods USA.
Heritage Foods USA hopes you had a great holiday season. For more specials on pork, beef, and other meats, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com.
We are back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Rachel Loudon about cuisine and empire, cooking in world history. And Rachel, right before the break, you did refer to your past life in as a historian of science and technology. Not past life, but your former career. And I see where it comes quite into play in some of the topics in this book. And they are also very important to the history of cuisines, and that is more of the cooking and processing techniques. There, a lot of these were shared and transferred. Can you talk a little bit about when what you refer to as the transfer of the cooking techniques? Or did I didn't mean to throw that at you, but I'm thinking more, I guess, in terms of just the equipment and maybe chocolate, you know, different grinding techniques.
Well, maybe a good way into this is to talk again about the arrival of the Spaniards in Mexico. The Spaniards, there's an illustration I love in the middle of the book that shows the Spaniards getting off a boat, and they are bringing absolutely everything with them to reproduce their cuisine. So they are bringing the seeds, obviously, to plant wheat. They are bringing millstones. They are bringing sacks to put the wheat in. They are also, although these are not illustrated, in their heads, they're bringing the knowledge to build bread ovens. They're bringing the knowledge to build the kind of stoves they like. They are bringing their cookbooks. They are bringing their copper pans instead of the clay pots that the Mexicans used. And so you can actually see, you know, that they are bringing the complete culinary package, the recipes, the utensils, the tools, and the ingredients to reproduce their cuisine in a new world. We hear a lot about the Columbian Exchange, you know, that there was a two-way street between the old world and the new, and that the new world's gift to the old was all kinds of new vegetables, maize, avocados, tomatoes, potatoes. But in fact, what's really interesting, if you think about it from a cooking point of view, is that there was very little culinary exchange. There was a one-way culinary movement from the old world to the new world, but very few of the new world cooking techniques made it back to the old world. The method of making tortillas never made it to the old world. The method of preparing nopales, the cactus paddles, never made it to the old world. The method of drying and rehydrating chilies and using them for flavor and color and texture as much as for heat barely makes it to the old world. And so one of the things I want to do is to, you know, divide to try to analyze in these big movements what is and isn't going and which way the techniques are moving.
Interesting. Yeah. Something else that we that I wanted to touch on, and that was your reference to high cuisine, or haute cuisine, as the French would say, and Amy Trubeck wrote a bit about that in her book of haute cuisine. And Jessica Harris even writes about it in Eating High on the Hog. In talking about high cuisine, of course, we can go back to the whole grain culture, right, and the accumulation of wealth, but talk a little bit about the high cuisine and how that really divided national cuisines more by class than a national cuisine.
This is, I think, absolutely key, because we live in such a funny world at the moment, viewed from the long perspective of culinary history. Because in the last couple of hundred years, at least in the West, the distinction between high and what I call humble cuisines has really broken down. It's true that we can, people will say to me, well, the rich still eat, fancier stuff than the poorer among us. And that's true, but basically everybody now can eat the same kinds of cuisine. In the past, there was a really huge distinction between high cuisines and humble cuisines. High cuisines, which were eaten by maybe 5 to 10% of the population at most, had plentiful meat, plentiful fat, plentiful sweeteners. They had exotic goods brought from long distances. They had processed foods. They had sauces and sweets and appetizers. They were prepared by male cooks in general, or professional cooks at any rate, and they were eaten in special dining rooms with special utensils, whether it was the Greeks reclining on benches at the symposium, or, the French in the 18th century eating off fine porcelain in dining rooms. Mm. And none of that was true of what most people were eating. They depended largely on grain, rice, or bread, very little in the way of meat or fat, no sauces or sweets. It was a home cuisine prepared by domestic cooks, and it was eaten out of a common bowl, usually with a spoon or the fingers, in without any special dining area. And that was the basic reality, and it mirrored the social and political reality of a small, landowning, monarchical, aristocratic elite, and a large number of people who actually did the work on the land.
Mm. It's interesting because you also mentioned you mentioned the social aspect of the dining habits, and very much of culinary study about the dining habits, and in the book you mentioned too, like, whoever thought that a meal meant a coming together and like a family meal or dining as a group, you did examine that quite a bit, and I found that very interesting.
Yes, I think we are so used it's almost a cliche now to say, the meal is the place where people come together, and it joins us. It is the spot where people can become friends, united families can gather together. And we see the family meal very much as the basis of the state, in the sense that children at the family meal are inculcated in the values of the society. But that's, meals can divide just as much as they can unite. And through most of history, the purpose of many, many of the meals was to reinforce one's rank in society, not to bring people together. Mm. So the king would eat separately, and the nobles would eat separately, and everybody would be seated according to their place in society.
That's right. Above the salt or below the salt?
Above the salt or below the salt.
Right. You asked the question, and I think it's a good one to leave our American listening audience with, to give them some food for thought, and that with all that you have written about in this book and in your studies, it kind of puts asunder maybe some of Americans' thoughts about a national cuisine, or addresses their uneasiness about whether we even have a national cuisine. You asked the question yourself, to talk about Americans' uneasiness about whether we have a national cuisine and about whether that question even makes any sense.
I think absolutely the Americans have a national cuisine. I think the confusion comes from a couple of things. One is that many people, and it's a perfectly legitimate way of using cuisine if you want to, identify cuisine with high cuisine. And, of course, America was, from its founding, was set its face against this distinction between high and humble cuisines, because it was founded as a republic in reaction to the monarchies of Europe. And so, therefore, from the very start, America adopted a belief and was able to put it in practice that people should be able to eat well. And perhaps just to round this out, Amelia Simmons, in her 1796 cookbook, begins by saying that she's going to offer cakes, and cakes that are suitable for all qualities of persons. Mm. And if you think, this is 1796, this is in the middle of the French Revolution, this is when in Europe people are fighting over whether or not you have access to bread, let alone cake. And Marie Antoinette did not, of course, say let them eat cake, but cake was in Europe beyond the reach of most of the population. And in America, there's Amelia Simmons saying, everybody's going to have cake. And American cuisine has been one of plenty of a cuisine that everybody can share. It hasn't been a single cuisine. It's been modified by everybody who's come in. But I think it definitely does have a distinctive cuisine, and the rest of the world, I think, believes that too.
Well, you certainly, using Amelia Simmons, gave a much better connotation to the phrase, let them eat cake, indeed. Well, Rachel, it has been an absolute pleasure, and I am still enjoying the book. As I said, I have savored every bit of it. There's so much in it that causes one to think also. It's not just one to take, and you have to digest it and think about it and see if maybe there are some criticisms or more questions to ask you, but I am enjoying the information that you are putting together in this, that you have put together in this book, and I thank you so much for sharing your time with me on A Taste of the Past.
It's been my pleasure, Linda. Thank you so much.
And please join us again here on heritageradionetwork.org for more on A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.